All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fuck knobs? Just made that one up. Swear to God, just came out of me. Welcome to the show. I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. I'm glad you're here. If you're running, how are you? Keep it going. Do it. Keep going. Yeah, sweat it out. Today on the show, Jimmy Dore, the comedian, comedy and everything else. You can get his book. He's got a book. Your country is just not that into you. It's available right now wherever you get books. I'll talk to Jimmy in a second. Jimmy was one of those guys, man. He was, before I really started doing the podcast, or maybe right at the beginning, I went to his home and he had me on his podcast, and I was able to see that that's how it went. That's how it goes. That was back in the day when we were all starting out, though. Jimmy was doing his a little longer than anybody else. He used to do it originally with Todd Glass, comedy and everything else. And now he does it with his wife. Yeah, he was one of the guys that inspired me to do it. Gave me my first break on a podcast. Him and Jesse Thorne and Keith and the girl. They were the ones that had me on and made me realize that, wow, I can do it. I can do it right in my house. I've always wanted to do it right in my house. So this is a little tip of the hat for Jimmy Dore, finally. Hey, I didn't have him on for a while. I had him scheduled, and then I didn't have him on. I thought there was tension between us, and turns out there really isn't. He's just a cranky guy. I'm just a cranky guy, and that's the way cranky guys are. They wander around thinking other cranky guys are mad at them when really they're just mad. Sensitive. Sensitive fellas we are. I went and saw Selma last night because I thought it was my responsibility as an American and as a man and as a white person to go see it. I wanted to see it. Of course, I like movies. I like Hollywood movies at times. I like big movies. I like good acting. I like a good story. I like a historical biopic occasionally. I enjoyed that James Brown movie. The last half hour of that movie's bizarre. I thought Selma was good, and I thought that the director's sort of focus on King as a man, as a human man, was great. The story of racist politics and racism in the South and the tensions and violence from that period. I mean, a lot of times, yeah, I think people need to be reminded of that. I know I need to be reminded of that. Sometimes movies are just provocative. And embarrassingly, if I could share my subconscious with you, embarrassingly, I dreamed last night after I saw Selma that I had a really horrible set in the South, that I was bombing on stage in the South, and it went on for a really long time. So that's some part of what my brain did with that. It personalized it, which is not surprising for a selfish man, but I thought it sort of captured the inherent white guilt and also the self-centeredness of how I would take a story like that. But it was devastating. It's a devastating movie, and it's surprising. I believe that the reality of it was probably much worse, obviously, than even what the movie could capture. And that, you know, that was this country, and that was this country, you know, 50 years ago, in most of our lifetimes, in my lifetime. It was a year ago. It was a few months ago in this country. Yeah. It's fucking astounding, man. Still there. I want to talk to my buddy Nick DiPaolo in just a minute. He's got a special out, and me and Nick go way back. I did one of my first gigs opening for Nick DiPaolo at Captain Nick's in Agunkwit, Maine. Yeah. I was probably 22 years old. Nick's not really that much older than me, maybe a year. But Nick's got a new special out, and I wanted to give him a call. So listen up. Me and Nick DiPaolo started out together. I got to get him on here for an hour, but he lives outside of New York, a little upstate New York. I got to get him on. But right now, his special, Another Sense Was Killing, is now available at his website at nickdip.com. You can get it there for $8. Let's call Nick DiPaolo. Let me call him.
Hello?
Nick.
Marcus Aurelius.
How are you, buddy?
What are you doing?
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah? So you live out in the country in a bunker?
Not yet. I'm building the bunker. I got the machine guns are on the way. canned peaches and spam. I live in Westchester, up in the woods. I'm like 40 miles north of the city.
Well, that's nice.
We're 40 miles from the Comedy Cellar, Mark, door to door.
Oh, God, that's a long haul at night,
it's
huh?
It's horrible.
Yeah.
I love my house. I love my privacy, but holy shit.
So what happened? So last week, you and I are okay, right?
Of course. How many times have you used that sentence when you talk to people? Probably 10 times a week.
Well, it used to be more. I thought I had cleared everything up with everybody. Over 500 episodes, I thought I...
First of all, I want to thank you for having me, you know, on the show. I mean, I know you have, like, Mel Brooks and, Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Butch Patrick and Dorothy Hamill.
Oh, yeah, all those guys. Me and The Rock. He's here now. He stayed over last night because he had to do an interview this morning. It was so funny because I got an email from some guy out of nowhere through my website. It said, so you're an asshole, and Greg Fitzsimmons and Nick DiPaolo think you're an asshole. And I wrote back, I said, well, that's a couple of assholes calling an asshole, so you must be an asshole for believing that.
I never called you an asshole.
I don't care.
I never called you an asshole. I just, on my podcast, I talked about when we were up at Montreal, we had just done, you know, Opie and Jimmy Norton show.
Oh, yeah.
Remember me, you, Attell, and like Billy Burr and eight other comics?
Yeah, it was crazy.
And then somebody said something about me, and you go, who, DiPaolo? He's irrelevant.
Oh, man.
And I went, that motherless fuck.
Yeah, I had it coming. I had it coming. What is this special, dude? When did it come out?
January 2nd. It's on, you go to nickdip.com. It's called Another Senseless Killing. It's like in the top 50 in pre-orders right now on iTunes, and it's been selling really well on my website, nickdip.com. It's $8. Some guy paid, you can pay as much as you want. Some guy paid $208 for it last week.
You're relevant to that guy.
Yeah, I ruled you out immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, no, it's, you know, it's selling pretty well, and I shot it at Acme in Minneapolis. So
the best, that's the
like
best
place. It's a bird's eye view, it's an intimate, it's, you know, the energy's there, and it's a little dirtier than even I like to work, but, you know.
Oh, yeah, well, it's, Acme's a great club.
Oh, it's my favorite in the country. That Lewis Lee, have you ever fucking met a fairer guy than, I mean... I walk out of there, I shot the, you know, I taped two shows like on a Tuesday night, and I walked out of there with like a lot of money in my pocket on top of it.
No, he's a good guy, aside from the fact that he banned me from his club for 12 years. But, you know, that I guess in his mind there was fairness there somehow.
Well, you said he was irrelevant to the comedy scene, didn't you, in an article or something?
Yeah, I did. No, I think I took one of his waitresses back to the condo.
Wait a minute, that's a true story.
Yeah.
Yes, I remember you telling somebody that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know what the hell I did, but he was a little weird like that. But, you know, we made up. Everything's
maybe
all right.
Maybe he was banging her.
I don't know. I think sometimes they just don't want, you know, the comic animal interacting with their their pristine staff of virgins and princesses.
Yeah, exactly. Like most of them are chlamydia-making machines.
Oh, well, but, I'm not going to say that.
No, I am. You don't have to say it. I just did. And I have the prescriptions to prove it.
You've got the record of prescriptions. Well, the special is called Another Senseless Killing. How long is it? Was it a long set?
It's an hour. Like 58 minutes. It was like an hour and 15 when I did it, but I chopped out some of I showed it to Louis, and I had a whole chunk of the Food Network that he told me to take out.
he actually told me that. I went to his house in New York the last time I was there, and we were just hanging out. And he said because it's taking up too much time, right? And it's not necessarily going to stay relevant.
The Food Network, I love it, first of all. I cook. I watch it all the time. It's like ESPN for me.
I love it, too.
And people, you know, that's a really popular thing in our culture. But it was kind of, it's funny, Mark, he's got good instincts, because when I put it in there originally, the material, I'm like, did I just sort of force that in there? Or I kind of questioned it myself. So as soon as he said it, I was like, yeah, he's probably right. It was kind of more mean. I was just ripping on the personalities and.
Oh, and you love it. So it probably did you. He probably did you a favor because isn't that interesting that you love the Food Network? Yeah. You just said to me, you sounded like you build your life around this fucking network and you take a dump on the fucking personalities.
You know, you're like a good shrink. That's true. I'm like you. I attack the shit I love. And
it's weird, right? God forbid we let anybody love us, right?
I was making fun of Barefoot Contessa. I said she had the hands and forearms of, you know, Alan Hale or some shit. Or whatever.
Yeah, you're sitting there with an apron cooking with her, doing one of her recipes.
I'm making her lemon squares, and I'm going, there's too much butter in this. What the fuck, fat fuck?
Yeah. I love to cook, man. I was away from it for a while, and now I started doing it again. I love it.
It's therapeutic.
Very. My problem is, like, I can spend hours making something that I can eat in 3 minutes.
Well, that's right.
That kind of
therein lies the problem. I've been trying to lose the same 18 pounds, but, you get older. I can't go out in the yard and run around and play football anymore. I get my hips and shoulders of a 90-year-old man, and... You have to pick up other shit.
It's hard. Like, I'm trying to lose a little weight now because I quit nicotine, and I feel like my whole metabolism changed. And I used to be able to knock off, 10 pounds in a month or so, but now it's a little harder.
I've never seen you really... Maybe the first time I met you when we did... I think you were fresh out of rehab when we did Captain Brian's or whatever the fuck.
That's right. I opened for you. One of my first paid gigs at Captain Nick's in Agunquit, Maine.
Yes, you were very nervous because you hadn't been on stage in like a few years, and you only had to do like 15 minutes, and you were shitting your pants.
Yeah,
I didn't really know of you at that point, but then when I saw him, I'm like, oh, this guy's a veteran. He knows what the fuck he's doing.
I was a mess. I was probably a little doughy, a little doughy. I'm trying to think when the hell that was. It must have been like right after I won the riot, so it was like 88, 89. Yeah, still had a little rehab weight on me.
Yeah. You looked, but every time I see you, you're in shape. But
yeah.
You look like, and like I said, you had the Frank Zappa goatee going.
That's what I got going now. Yeah, everything's going,
It looks
yeah.
good. You look good. I even said it to my wife. I go, Marilyn looks like he should be famous.
Thank God. It's about time.
He'll be working his personality. I mean, he'll go through the roof.
Yeah, I know. I got that one problem, my personality. What's your podcast called? Where's your podcast at?
My podcast is at riotcast.com. It's called the Nick DiPaolo Podcast.
How's that doing?
I was originally going to call it. I wanted to call it.
Fuck Mark Maron.
Wartime Consigliere.
Oh, nice.
I figured it would have been too hard to find on the internet. So, but yeah, it's Nick DiPaolo Podcast at riotcast.com.
It's going okay.
And I freaking love doing it, man. And you're a pioneer, so I thank you for plowing the way.
Yeah, are people enjoying it?
They're loving it. It's like I said, I check on it every couple days.
Yeah.
In the rankings.
Sure.
I know that doesn't really tell you that much.
Right,
but, it's always up there. So I've only been doing it about a year, Mark. So
what's great, man? I'm happy, man. You sound good. You sound good to me. I'm happy to hear that.
That's just the coffee. But
yeah, all right. Well, I'm glad I caught you at a good time then.
And trust me, when I went out to L.A. last week, you was the first show that came to mind. But honestly, God, I go, he thinks I'm fucking irrelevant. I'm not going to go on a show.
That's not true. If you would have given me a little notice, we could have sat down for an hour. Next time you're out here, let's just do an hour.
I would freaking love that, man.
No, absolutely.
I did all the other heavy hitters, and I didn't get you and Burr, so I want to get you guys next time.
Just give me a little warning.
I know. I called you like my plane was leaving in like an hour and a half. I'm like, yeah.
You want to meet me at the airport with your tape recorder? All right, buddy. Well, I love you, man. I wish you best of luck with the special. It sounds great. I'm going to go get it.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
Take it easy, buddy.
I'll see you later.
All right. That was it's my old buddy, Nick. Go check out his special, Another Senseless Killing. It's $8 at nickdip.com. So, crisis averted. I'm trying to do things differently, folks. I'm trying to do things differently. I'm trying to, I'm dating somebody, and I'm trying not to be a dick. And I felt a dick fit coming over me last night. I don't know if people can relate to this. I don't know if women can relate to it. It's got to be both sides, both sexes have to feel this. So where I don't know how emotionally available I've ever been in any of my relationships. I know I've been enmeshed with people. I know it's been crazy. I know I engage in drama. But, you know, how much have I opened my heart? How much does anybody really open their heart and just be comfortable being open-hearted and trusting somebody else and letting them in like that? I don't know that I've ever done it successfully or for real for very long. Like, generally, I get it open, then I'm like, oh, God, and I snap it shut. Sometimes I take someone's hand off. You know, it's dangerous. Might lose a hand in my heart. But last night we went out, we saw Selma, and then we started talking after the movie, and then she said something that kind of stuck in my craw a little bit, but I didn't really say anything about it because I thought it was petty. It was just bullshit. It was about nothing. It was about, you know, a director's job or a DP's job, who did what, who was responsible for what in particular, whatever. Doesn't matter. All right, but she was wrong. But it doesn't matter. I believe she was wrong. But I didn't need to bring that up. It wasn't, you know, why it caused that kind of trouble. But it sort of stuck in my craw. And then, you know, everything else was just filtering through that little thing. It, you know, got stuck in my brain engine. So now all the information was coming in, everything that was coming in during our interaction was sort of running past that thing that was just stuck there. Just, you know, stuck. And it was making everything shitty. And by the time I got home, I was like, you know, I was kind of like, I wanted to fucking fight, man. I knew it was just something had turned and I just wanted to fight. And I just sat there and she's like, what? And I'm like, well, all right, what happens now? What are we doing? And well, she's like, well, let's just relax and hang out, you know, and enjoy each other's company. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if that's going to happen. And it was just stuck. And I told, and I didn't, and then she said something and I snapped at her a little bit and she goes, you just want to fight. And I'm like, yes, I do. I do just want to fight. And I've had entire relationships like that that go on for years where I'm like this, where I just want to fight and I don't want to fight, but I don't know how I'm going to get through this. I need to get through this feeling right now. It's so fucking childish if you have this thing. Because you kind of just want to cry or just, you know, throw a little tantrum over bullshit. Just fucking grow the fuck up. I don't know how people have relationships and just keep that thing, that kind of thing in them. Just that festering resentment on both sides. It just sort of never goes away. And that's the baseline. It's just sort of, you know, just, you know, keep your feelings to yourself, you know, man up or whatever. But like, I just sat there and I told her what was going on. I didn't tell her why. I just said, I gotta wait till this passes. I assume it'll pass. And then like it started to, you know, I just let it, you know, I just kind of talked it out, played a little guitar. Had something to eat, had a lot to eat, shoved a lot of shit, just stuffed a lot of cereal over my feelings and some yogurt and some berries, which is relatively healthy for stuffing feelings. All I know is I didn't fight. And I've been in relationships where we're fighting and just tearing shit down was basically foreplay. But all I know is that we got into bed. We did have sex. That happened. I think there was an argument to be made that we should have done that right away, maybe right when we got home. There was an argument to be made for that. But something just, I was not there. But I'm not going to say that the tension didn't make it better. I'm not going to say that. Because there's, that I would be lying. But I do know that it was not a destructive situation. Now let's talk to my old friend, Jimmy Dore. You can, as I said before, you can get his book, Your Country Is Just Not That Into You. It's available wherever you get books. And we get through the crankiness, him and I. We do it. We get through it. We get past it. We get into the real thing. So you can see there was work being done on this workbench at some time. There were tools used, things happening.
Somebody was grinding down a thing. And
yeah, a lot of grinding, some pounding, maybe some valve repair.
Was there a vise anywhere hooked up to that?
I think the vise was over here somewhere because there's some padding here. I don't know. I haven't put it all together. I'm not a detective, Jimmy.
Nor am I.
You know, I'm not a forensic. I don't do forensics on arcane mechanical platforms.
I'm not a detective, but I do some forensics.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
You do some some cultural forensics.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
deconstructing.
That is, this is correct.
That's
wow.
right. That's sorting heavy, through it.
That is heavy duty the way you got into that.
Hell yeah, man. You're a cultural forensic examiner.
Yes, I. Oh, that's right.
Yes, I know.
I'm the Quincy of culture.
That's right. Thank God someone's doing it because no one understands how it died. Man, we're operating on all cylinders already.
Was it ever really there? People say, where do we ever really have culture? I don't know.
I think that there's this idea that we had civilization and that, yeah, there was culture. I think at different points, you know, the culture has been higher and lower. I think we're at a low point.
We certainly are at a low point.
You know,
we are certainly at a low point.
It doesn't seem like the standards are holding, whatever they might have been.
You're telling me you think the Housewives of New Jersey does not reflect well on our culture?
No, I don't think so. I think there's just too many outlets, Jimmy. There's too many outlets. Before, it was just three stations. Everybody was on the same page. Norman Mailer would appear on The Tonight Show.
Yes! Remember those days?
Kinda.
Me too. As a kid, I would fall asleep waiting for the comedian to come on.
Right.
But they would always have some author on who I couldn't give a shit about. Now, as a grown-up, I'd love to see those guys again.
Yeah, they're hard to see. You got to go find them somewhere.
Nobody talks anymore, Mark. That's why podcasts are so big.
That's right. I think they do talk, but just not on the outlets we're familiar with necessarily. And the few guys that do that type of talking might not be our cup of tea because there's only one. It's like either you're going to watch Charlie Rose or you're not. You know what I mean? I don't seem to make time for him.
I don't even make time for Bill Moyers. And every time I watch him, I'm like, God, that's mind-blowing. You know why? Because I think it's always a little depressing.
It hurts.
I mean,
you're better off just kind of like coming up with your one-liners about the fall of Rome as opposed to having it all explained thoroughly. And you realize, not only am I right, but it was much worse than I thought it was. That's the worst part about watching guys who actually do the work.
Yes. I'd rather not know. I'd rather just think this is a, you know, like a heat wave. It's not really climate change happening right now. 120 degrees
right.
in September in Los Angeles.
Oh, I thought you were using that as a metaphor for the end of everything.
Oh.
Like every day, like I drive around and there's these moments where I'm like, it's nothing. It's not coming back. Whatever it used to be, whenever there was some sort of value system in place, that shit is over. We get because of the internet access and just the ability for everybody to sort of kind of have no boundaries. It's become a completely predatory culture, and the planet seems to be heating up.
Definitely, the planet seems to be heating up. Also, people's bad behavior seems to be heating up. You know, people. It's just hard to keep up with all the kind of meanness in society. For proof, just go to any YouTube video, click on the fourth commenter, and the fourth commenter always mercilessly rips the third commenter, and then the fifth commenter, the newcomer, tries to create like a little common ground, and for that, the sixth commenter impugns his sexuality.
Sure.
So this is what's happening. Yeah.
That's commentary in the culture we live in.
And
it's a cat video.
Yeah. Yeah. And everybody's opinion matters just as much as everybody else's opinion. You know, used to be a time, you're right, talk about culture. There used to be a time when there were people whose opinions mattered more than other people's opinions, right?
Informed opinions, you used to think.
Yeah, informed. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And now it's just malignant punditry.
Yeah, everywhere.
Yeah.
Everybody's a talking head.
Why is this guy talking? Who is he? I don't know, but he seems confident.
And you never get discredited anymore. Once you're a semi-famous person or you have a Q factor, you never go away anymore. People will always keep bringing you on. Like, you know, what I talk about in my new book is, you know, look at all the Iraq war people. Nobody's ever discredited.
Or even, yeah, right. And if they are discredited or they are taken to task, that news is not as interesting.
How about Mike Barnicle? Now, mm-hmm. He's a perfectly affable
from
fellow.
Boston,
perfectly affable fellow.
Columnist,
plagiarizer.
Mm-hmm.
And still has a show right there on NBC, MSNBC. Still has and he doesn't have his own show, but he's still a panelist.
What was, did he get a, what was it, Carlin years ago that he plagiarized?
He plagiarized Carlin and some, and that wasn't the, that was the one that cost him his job.
That was the tip of the iceberg. It cost him his job at the paper.
Yeah, but he got promoted on television.
Right.
Yes. But he's a working man because, you know, he likes to give that appearance that he's a working man because he doesn't get his teeth fixed, even though he's a millionaire.
Right.
And his wife is the vice president of Bank of America. But he's the voice of the working man.
She's the vice president of all of Bank of America.
She is an executive at Bank of America. What are there 15 vice presidents?
Then it gets to the point though, Jimmy, where you're like, all right, so that guy, is he the enemy? Is he an annoyance? Is he really the guy we got to rally to get taken off?
No.
I mean,
I disagree with rallying to get people to take it. That's always backfires. Okay. I think, you know, the boycotts to get rid of people. Like when they got rid of Glenn Beck, they're like, yay, we got rid of Glenn Beck. We're going to replace him with five more Glenn Becks.
Yeah, it's like a Hydra. You just cut the head off and then is that
yes,
what
it is? Yes, and five more appear.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Not as bad as Glenn Beck, but Glenn Beck went and found his own way somehow.
Yep.
Glenn Beck, yeah, he got his people and now he still has probably half of them. So I got to say to you, I apologize for taking so long to get you on the show, because I owed you a debt of gratitude for having me on your show very early on when I think before I even started the podcast, I think you were one of the guys that I was like, well, what do we do? How do we do this?
Well, I remember when I first started listening to your show, I liked it a lot because I would I liked the part where you talked and the interviews less. I mean, I liked but when you talked, which is the opposite of what most people say. I don't know.
Yeah.
When you talk, because I would always learn, because you're so versed in self-help,
mm-hmm.
and you know all that stuff.
My own method, but.
But I would have this problem with my wife.
Yeah.
Who
you co-host your show with?
So we a podcast called Comedy and Everything Else, which we started with Todd Glass, and then
yes.
he left after episode 60.
Right.
And then we ended up doing about 180 total.
Oh, you don't do it anymore?
So it's in hiatus right now. We wanted to start doing live show with it, but I got really.
And your wife's name is what? Steph
Zamorano.
Yeah. Everybody loves her.
So she always had a problem. So I would get upset about something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like me, like once I get upset about it and then it gets resolved, it's over. It's out of me. It's over.
It's out of you and into her.
Well, that's what you said. You were talking about when you were married or whatever, and you would tell your wife, hey, it's over. I'm over with. She goes, yeah, it's out of you, and now it's in me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I didn't realize that was exactly what happened with Steph. It would be in her. Now, she'd be upset for a while, and it would take a while for it to get out of her.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize. And when you said that, I was like, wow, really open. It helped my marriage a lot. I'm not kidding. That's not blowing smoke up your ass. I was like, that really helped me.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And so I was glad to have you on the show. I think I shared it with you then. So even that little thing,
it's weird.
Helped.
It can take sometimes it is just a little thing that like those are the things that kind of make you think different.
Yeah.
Especially if they're easy.
Yeah. You know, like, that's very easy.
Yeah. Because everything's so fucking complicated and you're like, this has got to be deeper than this. And you're like, well, why not? You just don't do that. Oh, all right. I didn't realize that was an option. I can just stop doing that. I have choices in life over my behavior. But when did you start podcasting? I mean,
we were pretty early on. I think we might have started in 2008.
Wow.
Maybe?
Right.
I can't remember exactly.
But then again, we weren't, I mean, you weren't necessarily the first, but the landscape when you started and also when I started was so small.
So it was just a handful, right? Yeah, it was just a handful of people. Jimmy Pardo was the first one I remember.
Yeah.
And then, I don't, maybe Adam,
right, Carolla and Kevin Smith, sort of.
Yeah, Kevin Smith, correct, right. So then we got in right around then.
Right.
And Todd had a bigger vision for it than I did. I thought it was just going to be us kind of talking and goofing off. I didn't realize what it could be.
Right.
Right, like you've realized what it could be.
Well, I mean, I just did what I landed on. You know, like, I don't know that I had any vision other than, you know, I can do whatever I want. And it sort of evolved into this thing where I need to talk to people.
Yeah.
But you've been doing comedy how long?
So I started my first open mic 1989.
Right.
So I moved out to L.A. in 1995.
From where?
From Chicago.
So you're a Chicago guy.
Yeah.
Born and raised in Chicago. Chicago in the city?
Yes, right in the city, right by Midway Airport.
Really?
Blue-collar neighborhood, really blue-collar, or as I like to describe it, racist.
What neighborhood is that?
It was Vidom Park, Southwest Side, the 23rd District.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's interesting because I go to Chicago. I've not spent an extensive amount of times there.
Yeah.
But you know, there are certain cities in this country where you're like, oh, this is a real thing.
Chicago's
like,
a real city.
Yeah, it's like Philly, Chicago,
yeah.
New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, I think.
Boston.
Boston, definitely.
Those are real cities.
Those are the ones,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. So you can walk around it still.
They got a personality.
And
there's
they have a person. Exactly. They do have a person.
An identity.
In Chicago, by the way, my neighborhood is a great neighborhood. I tease them about being racist because they were.
It's a white blue-collar neighborhood?
Yes.
Like what, is primarily Italian or Irish?
Irish, Italian, Polish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What are you?
I'm Irish and Polish.
Really?
Yeah, but everybody always thought I was Italian. I don't know why.
You got brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I come from 12 kids.
So you're really Irish.
And so that's kind of, yes, really. So that's where...
12 fucking kids, dude.
That's, well, so I... And
what
the joke,
number are you? Do you know?
Yes. Can I tell you the joke I tell about
tell
it?
Tell the joke.
Is that I come from 12 kids, and people say you learn a lot about life growing up in a big family, which is true, and I think the biggest thing I learned is I'm easily replaced. Right? Like, I knew if I died, it wasn't going to put a big dent in their plans. Can't imagine my mom sitting around, oh, no, Jimmy's dead. What am I going to do now with just the 11 of you?
Yeah. There's a head count every day. I think we're missing one.
Yeah, I wish there was. There wasn't sometimes, and then they would leave you behind on the camping
trip. But that's not true. Usually when I talk to people from big families, the relationship with the parent is there's always a different relationship, but they all seem to love the kids as much as the other one.
Yeah, I felt favored, actually,
because
I was the youngest. So
you were the youngest of 12? So do you have siblings that are 70?
Yeah. So I have a brother who's at least... 63.
At least you don't even quite know. That's hilarious.
They're very old.
come on.
I don't even remember my oldest brother living at home. He was like an uncle. I never remember living with him. So yeah, it's really like, and in fact, he had a kid who's older than me. So I have a nephew older than me, stuff like that. So it's weird. It's wild.
It fascinates me. So you all lived in the same house, kind of, or was there maybe what, 8 of you there at the most? Or
so
seven?
There was probably, I think at any given time, there was, I think the most we ever had was 10. But when I went to school, my mom literally didn't know what to do with herself all day, right? Because she's used to taking kids. So now we're all in school. And she went and adopted two more kids.
No, she didn't.
Yeah, so we had 10 kids and she adopted two more, so then we had 12. One, a boy who was older than me, 1 year older than me, who could beat the shit out of me. Hey, thanks, that's what I need.
Yeah,
another guy who can beat the shit out of me in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you wonder why I'm going to comedy.
Yeah.
And then I had a little sister who I loved. It was great having a little sister, my little sister Dolores, fantastic.
So what'd your dad do?
He was a cop, and he was an honest cop, which sucked for me because, you know, we had to wear hand-me-downs and eat the powdered milk, milk.
Wasn't taking anything under the table, huh?
No, that's what I'm saying. I wish he would have.
Was he like a beat cop? Was he like a regular cop or a detective?
He was just a beat cop, and that was it. Yeah.
A beat cop?
He used to drive a paddy wagon.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, and yep. Mm-hmm.
Is he still around?
And yeah, he's still alive, yeah. And he worked, his other job was he would do masonry. And then the sons, we would work with him in the summer doing masonry work, which if you ever want to fuck up your relationship with your parents, work with them.
Yeah.
Especially doing shitty grunt work like that.
Bricks.
In the hot summer and the humid summer. It's great. It's really good for your relationship.
But I can't understand. So how many sisters you got? How many sisters and brothers?
There's seven boys, five girls in my family.
And are you in touch with them?
You know what's funny is that we were pretty close. I used to enjoy my family's company a lot because my brothers are funny and my mom has a good sense of humor. My dad, no sense of humor.
None?
Whatsoever.
Was he a hard ass?
Yeah, just really shut down.
Yeah.
And
drinky?
So, here's the thing. My grandpa was an alcoholic, so my dad was going to do him one better, and he didn't drink at all, right? So that was my dad's attempt to do better. So my dad still had all that anger and rage of an alcoholic. So we got to have all that, but we never got to experience any of the fun drunk times.
Right, yeah. No relaxing. Just a constant current of varying degrees of rage.
Exactly. Well, the way I describe it, I say my dad had two emotions, angry and not angry yet.
He's so, oh my God. So how the hell does he keep, how did he manage 12 kids?
He didn't manage it well. he wasn't around much because he was working all the time. And then when he was home, he was grumpy and hitting us.
Oh really? There was some beatings going on?
All the time. Are you kidding? We grew up poor. Poor people beat the shit out of each other. Everybody's hitting everybody. They're hitting me at home. They're hitting me at school. I go to the park. We beat the fuck out of each other. Everybody's beating the fuck out of everyone. You grew up poor. I don't know if people realize that.
Where else are you going to put the anger?
Yeah,
no
exactly.
Justice. It's no justice.
It's no justice.
That explains your comedic disposition.
Yes.
The little guy.
There you go.
The little guy's got to fight back.
That's why I'm always punching upward.
Yeah, yeah. And equally as futile as it was when you were a child.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
People appreciate your sentiment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's all I want. That's all I want. Hey, I appreciate that sentiment.
Hey,
buddy.
You're fighting a good fight. We're going to go to our house now where it's comfortable.
We're going to turn on our corporate television.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, well, that's interesting. So you were getting it from all ends. What did he beat you with? Were there instruments involved?
No, mostly hands. It was, yeah. My dad was a big motherfucker.
Oh, yeah? So, no, yeah. No belts, no sticks.
Didn't need it. No, didn't need it at
hand
all.
Hand was enough.
No, my dad punched me one time so hard I pissed my pants.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, it wasn't fun.
How old were you?
The first time I was 5, second time I was 16.
Pissing, you know, so there was a 11-year gap between the pissing of the pants?
Yeah. Yeah.
What, did you go out? I mean, was it like, were you unconscious?
Yeah. The second time, yes.
So he punched you?
Yeah, right in the face.
Oh, my God. For what?
I was drunk. I came home drunk.
Uh-huh.
And I was on the corner of my block. And I was yelling, like I was being drunk, yelling. I don't know, maybe it was 10:30 at night or something.
At anybody in particular? Or?
No. I was there with a friend of mine, Jerry Snyder. We were both hammered. And yeah. I was like, blah, blah, blah. You know, I was just kind of like spouting.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, my friend Jerry Snyder goes, hey, shut up. Here comes a cop. Yeah. And I look up, I go, that's no cop. That's my dad.
Oh, no.
And my dad just walks up and just fucking plows me. He punched me right in the face.
And that was it? Did you get in the car?
And then
what?
He picks me up. And then he put me in a headlock and he punched me all the way home.
No way.
Yes, Mark, come on. I grew up blue collar. These are men.
Yeah, but no, that's a child abuse.
I agree. But that was commonplace. You know, my next door neighbor was an alcoholic Marine and he was constantly yelling. And so we thought we had it much better.
Right.
So we were
yelling,
like,
at who? His kids?
Everybody. His wife, his kids, the paper man.
Vietnam Marine?
Oh, I don't, must have, I don't know, maybe, yeah. Who knows, but he was a big drinker, and, but at least he was like, I would see him every once in a while, we'd have block parties, and he would be giggly. I'm like, I wish my dad was like that once in a while.
Get him a drink, one drink. Your dad never had one drink?
One time I saw him have he had some champagne at my brother's, and he got a little tipsy, one time.
Did you know your grandfather, the drunk?
Yeah.
Was he a good guy?
I didn't really know him. Oh. So I just wanted to go over there, and he died when I was in second grade.
But was he like in the neighborhood? Was this everybody in the neighborhood? Your other grandparents, your mother's folks? Where were they?
My mother's folks, it's all very secretive. My mom won't tell me about her family. She goes, oh, the building burnt down with the records of my family. And,
really?
And I was like, what? So I was convinced for a long time my mom's mom was a prostitute. Because they all had funny names. My mom's name is Yvonne. My aunt's name is Aloma.
Huh.
Like, and I'm like, oh, was she like, was that a pimp giving names out or something, you know? But that's not, turns out that wasn't it. But
did you find out what it was?
It was, I think something, those names came from operas or something.
But why?
Oh, no. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, but you're a smart
secret,
guy.
Secrets.
You never went and did the research. Your mom still around?
Yes. Yeah.
And now at this age, you don't sort of like, come on, let's just.
When my grandmother died, my mom didn't even tell us.
Wow. And
she went to the funeral and all that stuff. And I'm sure all my cousins went. And I'm sure they were wondering, where the fuck are the rest of the doors?
God, that sounds interesting to me. And you never, like, what's stopping you from pursuing that information? You just don't care or what?
I just really don't care. I really couldn't care less about my mom's family. I couldn't care less about my extended family. I really couldn't. I have some fun cousins. I have some fun nieces and nephews. I like them and love them a lot, you know? But I don't really care about, like, when I was a kid, I had a hard track keeping track of my brothers and sisters.
Sure.
And then we would have these big family things with the cousins and the uncles. And I go, this is your Uncle Ned. This is your Uncle Fry. I couldn't keep them straight. I couldn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Say hi to your Uncle Mush. I had a guy named Uncle Mush. Say hi to your Uncle Mo. I'm like, I don't even.
I can understand that. But I guess, like, because I forget. I'm sitting here grilling you.
One time.
But I don't keep up with my cousins. I don't, you know.
My brother, and so we did masonry, and then my dad retired. So my brother kept doing the business.
Which, the oldest brother?
My brother, Tony. He's the third oldest boy. And so he goes, hey, I got this job. Come help me. I got to fix this chimney on this house. He goes, they're relatives of dad's. It's dad's cousin or something.
Yeah.
He goes, they're going to start. Don't let them know you're a door. They'll never stop talking to you.
Right.
So I go, oh, okay. So we go to fix it. And I'm just going to run up the ladder and fix the chimney with the bricks or whatever. And the guy comes out, starts talking to Tony.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. So we come down. Like, hey, come on in and have lunch.
Yeah.
And my brother Tony goes, okay. I was like, no, that's not. So we go in to have lunch. And we're so the whole time I'm pretending I'm not Jimmy Dore.
Right.
I'm someone else. And the woman is looking. And she brings out the family chart. They have it all, like the tree.
Yeah.
and she starts going out, and I see my fucking name on it.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, and I look just like my brother.
Right.
I look just like my everybody in my family, you know?
Right.
Blue eyes, dark hair. I look exactly like
him. Right.
And the woman's looking at me, and she's just, I just knew she was bullshitting. 2 weeks later, I was at a wedding, and she was there.
She was there.
Yes.
Why didn't you say anything?
Because my brother told me. I thought we're going
to. Didn't she say something?
She didn't like call me out right then, but she. I knew she knew.
Yeah.
So that was kind of funny.
So do you? I mean, do you check in with your brothers occasionally?
Yeah, I check in. My brother Miles and Tony, I'm tight with.
Yeah.
We had my family kind of paper. Like we're so like I said, my parents were adult children of alcoholics
yeah.
who never really fixed it, so they were with dry drunks. Right?
Yeah. Right.
And
both of them.
I don't know about my mother so much, but she certainly has some drama issues, that's for sure.
I would say so.
And
hiding her mother's identity would be one of them.
Yeah, those are secrets, right?
Yeah,
that's the shame spiral, right?
Sure. You're only as sick as your secrets, they say.
They say.
Yes.
Right. So, yeah, so we papered over our problems pretty well.
Yeah.
And I moved out here in 95, so I really didn't see my family that much since then.
How old were you?
30.
Really?
Yeah. When I moved out here.
Where'd you start doing comedy? So what were you going to say? Your family, what?
But it kind of fallen apart in the last couple of years. Tough to cold. There's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I got some, you know, be honest, I got some knuckleheads in my family.
Sure. Like what kind of knuckleheads?
Like real knuckleheads. but I got some great people in my family too. I don't want to shit on my family.
Politically, you have problems?
Yeah. Not only that.
Yeah.
There's that.
Yeah.
I got, I don't want to say, it's not good. It doesn't reflect well on me to speak. You know, you have to love your family, Mark. It builds character.
Sure. You got to pretend to publicly is what
we're
learning.
Yes, that's what I'm doing. You have to pretend to. But my brother Phil's coming in. Anyway, let's go.
He's got one shot in at Phil.
Can I tell you, here's the joke. I wrote my brother Phil.
Yeah.
Here's the joke. Here's who he
is. Okay.
So my brother Phil made about 50 grand a year selling house. He was a real estate agent. He didn't do well, but he took a job driving a school bus for the health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I'm out at his house out of nowhere. He starts complaining about the estate tax.
Uh-huh.
He goes, "Hey, we got to get rid of that estate tax." I'm like, "Sure, Phil, what the fuck are you talking about?"
Uh-huh.
He goes, "That's if you die and you have millions of dollars, the government just takes half of it."
Yeah.
I was like, "That's horrible. Let me know when that becomes a problem." But until then, maybe you should turn off your AM radio, get invited to your own life, okay?
Yeah.
I'm sure the estate tax sucks, but I'm pretty sure estates don't have two cars that don't work on the front lawn. You should be worrying about the t-shirt tax at Walmart, you dickhead.
Uh-huh.
So that's who he is.
He picks up the talking points and runs with them.
Hard.
Yeah.
And then threatens to beat you up if you don't
agree
with
him. Well, you know what's interesting is that how one of the things I learned from doing political talk in my personal revelation around it was that if you are fundamentally angry, you know, you pick your side and you work those talking points. That, you know, like it's interesting, you know, how many people are really actually committed ideologically to facilitating change or working quietly to make it happen. Those people are sort of like they're the unsung heroes, the people that actually chip away at a grassroots level to change
the
legislation.
Yes.
Sure. You know, on a city level or community level.
There's a group I'm involved with now called Wolfpack, and they're dedicated to getting money out of politics because people, when I go and to promote this book all around, people always go, "Oh, Jimmy, so you've identified the problem. What's the solution?" They don't expect me to have one. And the solution is you get money out of politics. And there's a great group called Wolfpack, wolf-pack.com, and they started. They want to pass a constitutional amendment around this issue to get money out of politics, which you can, you know, every generation has passed amendment except us. So it's about time, right?
Yeah.
And they started with New Hampshire. They got New Hampshire to pass it.
What is the exact terms of the legislation? What does it mean to get money out of politics?
So that
you put a ceiling on it?
So what they're going to do is, I think they're going to call for public financing of all elections.
As
opposed to private finance. And then people go, "Well, that costs a lot of money." Well, you and I both know, Mark, it costs us a lot more money to not have it public financed.
Right.
Because the reason why people finance elections is so they can rig the system in their own favor. That's special
one
interest.
One way or the other.
Either
in a very dubious way or just by pummeling us with advertising and misinformation.
So people said, sure, you got New Hampshire. It's a small state, but you'll never get a big state like California where they have defense contractors and oil money. There's too much money here. California passed it too. And now last week in the Senate, they passed a resolution to open debate for calling a constitutional amendment on this issue. The ball is moving. People are getting awake to this. I bet you politicians hate it too. Politicians hate raising money. Uh-huh. They spend most of their time raising money. I'm sure they would love to get money out of politics.
Well, it's interesting how many people will, it really comes down to how many people get active around this stuff. I mean, I'm sitting here with the, you know, I've avoided jury duty once and they sent it back. They want me and I'm like, is there anything I can do to avoid my civic duty to go sit quietly and judge in a context where it's actually invited?
That's right. Have you gone?
No, one time I got called and I called in and I was lucky because it was Christmas, so I didn't get have to go down there. And then I got another one. They seem to hit me every year. I don't get any break from it. And you get one out. And that, so I took that, and now I got the thing, and they want me to show up. And it's hard with what we do. I mean, I think those rules were made when people just had jobs where they worked in town. I mean, what do I got to do?
I can't imagine how someone could sit on a jury trial for more than a couple days. You know what I mean? Like, even the Zimmerman trial. So then it makes you wonder, who are these people? You think they're morons, right? I'm like, who are the people who aren't smart enough to get out of jury duty or don't have a life that this would disrupt enough to have to get out of jury duty?
But it's interesting. You talk to people, like I talk to people and my friends who are intelligent people, and in their guts, they do see it as like, well, you got to do it. It's a civic
like
duty.
It is a civic duty.
And there's so few that we're actually held to. You know, like obeying laws is that should be sort of a passive thing. But like there's one thing where it's sort of like, can you show up and you know, I don't know, man.
I have a hard time. It's really, someone told me just don't return the notice.
That's what I heard too. But I guess I'm the only idiot that's compelled by guilt to say like, all right, what do I got to do? Oh my God, I can't do it.
On the positive side, Mark, I've never ever heard of a prosecution over someone not going to jury duty. Have you?
No, they threatened $1,000 fine and up to 3 days in jail.
Yeah.
Or community service.
But I've never heard of it happening. Have you?
No, but there's always a first.
They're going to make an example out of us.
They're going to make it. But the weird thing is I don't even know if I go down there and I say, look, I run a radio show. You know, I have a voice in the world. Am I the guy you want on this? Because are they going to swear me to secrecy? They can't do that.
Oh, maybe they can sequester you, right?
I don't
make them a gag rule on you.
Yeah, but why would they bother? They'd be like, next.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
You know, like, you're right. We, you know, yeah, I did political talk radio for 3 years. You know, I have a substance abuse issue. I'm sober 15 years. I don't know if I'm the guy.
And I have a big mouth.
Yeah, and I'm a stand-up comedian with a podcast. But I'll do it if you need a guy.
I'm willing to fill in.
So what did you, go to college?
Yeah, I went.
Where at?
I went to Illinois State for 3 years. You know what they say, if you can't go to school, go to state.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, state schools are
college is a scam. And then I got my degree from Columbia College in Chicago, not Columbia University.
Right.
But I just put Columbia on Facebook so people don't know the difference.
Right. Is that the one you can do online now, Columbia?
No. This is it's an art school in Chicago. It's actually a great school. Now, when I went there, because they took all my credits from Illinois State. They were the ones who would take most of them.
What were you studying?
Communications, and I was going to go into advertising. I got my degree in marketing communications.
Yeah, you were going to go into advertising?
Yeah, I was going to write copy, right? Beat laying bricks. That was my other option.
And also, there's creativity to writing copies.
Yeah, and the thing I liked about advertising, Mark, is that there's no rules. So you can write a one-word sentence with a period. You could put a period after one word. I like that.
Well, it's fortunate now that culturally there are no rules anymore. Either.
Now there aren't any rules because of tweeting and all that. There's no more. You can do whatever you want.
That's right.
So, but that's what drew me to writing copy for advertising, that there were no rules. So I couldn't do it wrong.
Right.
So it freed me up creatively.
Right.
But I never got a job because as soon as I got out of college, I went right into doing stand-up.
But you did 1 year at the art school?
Yeah, about three semesters.
And what were you doing there? You were actually trying to write copy and pursue advertising?
Yeah, I was learning advertising. I learned a lot about it.
So you applied for ad jobs, for copy
Not
jobs?
One. Not one. I got out. I was like, you know what? I don't want to get a job this summer. I'm going to have one more summer where I drink my head off.
Yeah.
And have fun with my friend John McGuire.
Yeah.
And John Caparelli. We're going to go drinking. And then... And during that time, I started doing comedy. My friend John Caparelli said, hey, you know, there's an open mic at this comedy club over here. And I was like, get out of here. And he said, yeah. And the guy who wins on Thursday gets to go up on the Friday. And I was like, I'll go.
Are they comics, John McGuire?
No, these are just cops. He was a John Caparelli was a cop friend of mine in Chicago, and John McGuire is a works for the Chicago Transit Authority.
I think I know a Chris McGuire who's a comic.
Yeah, he's a writer for Comedy Central.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Chris McGuire, great guy. But so that I went to the open mic, and that was at the time when, you know, they were handing out comedy club jobs. You know,
Zanies.
So I got a comedy. I went to a place called the Comedy Womb. That's where, and their thing was, that's where comedians are born. Get it? Comedy
Clever.
Boom.
Yeah, you should have offered to write them some ad copy. You get a different angle on that.
That was the play. I mean, to me, that was like Taj Mahal.
But no Zanies.
That was the Taj Mahal. I worked Zanies, sure.
But like the comedy.
But that was, I waited to go to Zanies because I was intimidated. Like, to me, that was the big place.
It was the big place. But what year was this?
1989.
That's about when.
That's the boom, baby. That's when the funny.
End of the boom.
Yeah.
Well, end of the first boom, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Because I started working professionally in 88. And already people were like, yeah, it's not what it used to be.
Oh, really? They were already saying that then to you?
Yeah, but that was the end of that first weird because, 80s boom.
Yeah, because clubs were still opening in Chicago until about 91, and then that was it.
Yeah.
And it was just, man, it went fast.
Really?
Yeah, it went really fast. Clubs started closing left and right. There was an improv, which was a 450-seat room. Then there was a place called the Funny Firm, literally around the corner from each other in downtown Chicago, both 450-seat rooms.
I think the improv is still there, isn't it?
Mm-mm. There's an improv in Chicago, but it's not where it was.
Oh, okay. Well, so what were you sort of focusing on initially as a comedian? Who were your guys, like the ones that you listened to? And
so, you know, I mean, I had the usual favorites. George Carlin, right? Yeah. Boy, that was such an awakening when I heard him. I loved him so much. And then I also loved Jerry Seinfeld, right? And then I thought I was pretty good. I was like, I got this. I think I know what I'm doing with comedy. I was in about 3 years in. I was like, I'm pretty good.
Were you featuring
Featuring, headlining B rooms, featuring A rooms. I was like, I know what I'm going to be a headliner soon. Look out for me. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then I saw this guy named Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
He came to Chicago and I sat down and watched him in my special spot. And the first 5 minutes, I was like, wow, this guy's really something. 10 minutes, I was like, somebody get me a drink. And after about 20 minutes, I was pretty sure I was quitting comedy.
Yeah, I gotta go. Bill seems to have covered everything.
Because I always thought, you know, like I could, you know, be the best. If I do everything right, I could maybe be.
So you saw him in the late 80s?
Then I saw him, early 90s, so like 93.
Right before he died.
Right before he died. So like maybe 92, maybe even. So, because I saw him probably, I don't know, I would say at least 50 sets I saw him do at Chicago. And because he played there 4 weeks a year. And so I would go anytime he was in town, I would be there, right? After I saw him that first
every
time.
Every night.
And see, the thing is, I always thought I could be.
Did you ever see him walk a room?
Yeah. So half a room.
Yeah.
So I thought that I could be the best someday. And then when I saw Bill Hicks, I knew that for the rest of my life, I was going to be competing for second place. And that really hurt.
Well, but why?
I don't know why, because I was immature, and that's why I thought.
But I mean, we all do it, but there is a sense after. I mean, it took me 20 years to realize, like, I do what I do.
Well, that's what I had to realize.
But
I realized, well, he did. Well, thank God he died, and I didn't have to compete with him. So I had that going for me. I was like, that's really nice of him to go young. I realized that after he died, everywhere I went, somebody was trying to be Bill Hicks. You know, trying to be in their face and smoking on stage, which is the least badass thing you could do.
I think I was one of those guys.
It's okay.
Yeah.
And so, but you didn't do it like, I'm in your face smoking, right? You were one of those guys, were you?
No, I don't know. Like I really was fairly careful not to watch him too much, you know, but I think there was something about, there was a lot of people that were actually kind of doing his cadence and stuff.
Oh, no doubt about it.
And, you know, but it was still, it took a unique type of comic to even attempt that. I mean, like, you see that all the time. I mean, there are certain people that have a contagious cadence. Attell, you know, Todd. You know, there are certain people that are sort of stylized in how they deliver Joe Hedberg.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, I mean, I think that's just part of a comic's growth. And, you know, hopefully you get out of that or at least make it your own. You know, Brian Regan. See around recently.
When I first worked with Norm MacDonald, I sound like him for about 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's hard. It's like if you're a writer, you do that. You know, you read a book and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, my God, I'm Vonnegut. I got it. But I don't think that's abnormal. But the content of what Hicks did, the thing is like Hicks, you know, held a line where, you know, there was there was an aggressive lack of pandering, you know, to the point where, you know, the territory that he claimed for himself on stage was uniquely his because he didn't, you know, his satire was so deep and the type of truths that he decided to eviscerate and do it so lyrically were so kind of raw that people did not know how to contextualize him as stand-up. So, like, the people that understood it and were like, this guy's the second coming, you know, were far outnumbered by the people like, nah, he's making me uncomfortable. But that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, so, because so if you, everyone likes him, then it makes it less special in a sense.
But there's just no way, because he was really, you know, he had taken up the torch of you know, hardcore satire and speaking truth to power in a way that no one really had. But unfortunately, as we've talked about earlier, the culture was changing and relevance became harder to sort of garner. Mm-hmm. You know, like at the time Lenny Bruce was around or whatever, you know, when Lenny Bruce got busted 9 times, I mean, it was going to be carried by the national media.
Yeah.
You know, Hicks walks a room, there's 3 comics going, that was cool. You know, so.
Yeah, he didn't get arrested.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And he should have.
Yeah, you know, just it for, certainly would help.
Yeah, but yeah, he was
what
great.
He got, you know what? In fact, when he got canceled from David Letterman, that was like one of those things that got him notoriety.
Right, but
more
even,
than
but,
actually
but
doing
even
the
then,
set.
It was so late.
It was so late.
I felt that too. So how did you regroup? I mean, what, you know? Okay, so you watch Bill Hicks. And-
so when I saw all these other people that I thought were doing an impression of him, and it kind of repulsed me a little, or it made me not want to be that. I was like, I don't want to be that. And then, I just realized that I got to be who I am, and I didn't want to be angry on stage like them, right? I wanted to be able to, like, not be that way. So I went the other way.
A little control.
So I upped the charming part of myself on stage a little, even though I still had maybe a little bit of a rough edge just because I come from where I come from. And so I did it that way. And I instead of being that confrontational, I would be more confrontational with the ideas and not my manner.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a good choice. Like, I never made that choice. It had to happen naturally, because mm-hmm. a lot of that for me was just, you know, I was angry, but I was just angry. You know, I could sort of, like I was saying before, is that if you gave me a reason, and I thought, well, that's a good reason, I'll just redirect some of the anger that I have in my parents into this reason.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it was more of a psychological thing for me that I couldn't stop being angry until I got comfortable with myself. Like, it wasn't a choice I made. It was like some of it naturally went away, and
right.
some of it was just sort of like, you know, what are you really doing up here? Because you can hide behind anger. Anger is the easiest thing in the world to fucking. It's hard to make funny. I imagine a
See,
lot of
this is one of those times when I'm learning from you again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it's like a lot of those guys I bet you're talking about now, that where are they?
Nowhere.
Right. I mean, like, that's the weird thing about angry comedy is that there's only one or two guys at any given time that can pull it off. And then there's a lot of guys thinking they can. But it's hard. It's easier to be cranky.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say Lewis Black is cranky.
No, he's a great crank.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a rare thing, and it's one of the greatest comedic archetypes there are, because, like, Letterman's an honest crank.
Yeah.
To be an endearing crank is such a fucking gift.
Yes.
Because you can't manufacture it.
No, right.
And if you're too angry, there's no charm to it. Yeah, but to be the guy that's sort of like, what's going on?
I like George Carlin when he was angry. In fact, he got angrier as he got older, it looked like.
I think Hicks had a profound impact on him.
I think so, too. I think so too, and I think it seemed like he was kind of like what I did was try to confront with the ideas and be kind of charming, which is how he was. And then maybe Bill Hicks influenced him. Go ahead, just be angry if you feel like it. And he was old enough to where he didn't give a fuck.
That's right. I mean, it's too bad we don't have the option to ask him, but I think he's made comments about Bill, and I think that, like, it was clear to me that, because Carlin was really the sort of precedent for what you do in a way. You know, to be.
I'd like that. He's more of my template.
Right.
Actually.
To be clever, to be mm-hmm. smart, mm-hmm. to take on sacred cows, but not to, you know, hit it over the head with it necessarily. And if you're going to make sure you got a good button on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think that, like, you know, something later in his life, you know, outside of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel or whatever is at the end, I'm sure he wouldn't say it was a light, but he was like, what do I care? Mm-hmm. I can do an hour a year. And if it gets more weird and more angry, who cares? Like, there were points in later Carlin where you're like, what?
You know? I know. I saw him, though, right before he died, I saw him do a set at the Comedy Magic Club. And I'd only seen him in big venues, right? And so I got to sit in a club and see him. And, you know, when you're in a room that's small, which is, I think, a better I don't know, shape for comedy.
Yeah, not the best.
You could, I could feel the funny in his bones instead of the funny in his ideas.
Right.
So I could feel the funny in his bones, just the way he looked, or his eye went up. I could see his eyebrow go up, but I could see the way he paused and the look in his eye. You know, that's to me the moments in between, like the jazz players talk about. Those were the moments I picked up on in the comedy club, and it was thrilling.
Oh yeah, no, it's great to see comedy like that. And also, I think Carlin was, you know, insanely controlled. That I, from what I understand, everything was written. Every decision that he made was on the books, you know, was on his paper, was in his mind. You know, there was, like, the one thing about Hicks and seeing Hicks was that whether it was all written out or not, there was a menace to it. And, you know, at any given point in time, you didn't know whether he was just going to, like, you know, where it was going to turn. And it was like, fuck all of you.
Right.
And there was an improvisational element just to the sort of like, this could go really bad really quickly. Whereas I think Carlin, even later, was very controlled. I mean, you never got the feeling he was improvising ever.
Right. No, I didn't. But the beauty of George Carlin, also for me, one of the things I liked is that he remained an outsider, even though he was a cultural icon. He still, I think, always stood a step or two outside of the culture, which gave him that thing where, you know, Jerry Seinfeld talked about it on that HBO show where he was given that award. He goes, I'd rather be standing in the corner making fun of me up here getting this award. And that's kind of where George Carlin stayed, which is what I think helped keep. He was on the cutting edge of comedy till the day he died.
Well, that's also because he was only ever a comic. That, you know, whatever, that was always his job.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever, you know, TV opportunities, which were minimal and they came and went, and he was never anything but George Carlin.
Right.
Like, there's only a few guys now that really do that were like, because I watched Gaffigan the other night, and I hadn't seen him in a while, and I'm like, I got to go back to, like, it used to be I'd see Hicks, I'd be like, I got to rethink everything. Now, like, to see Gaffigan's skill set.
Right.
Even though he talks about what he talks about, the flow, the jokes per minute, the sort of comfortability, the sort of groundedness in his person. He's a guy that does comedy, 200 nights a year for large rooms. He's completely clean. He's a family. It's his job. Mm-hmm. Brian Regan's another one. And, you know, someone like Carlin, that's it. That was it. That's all he did. And the same with you.
No, I'm doing lots of other things now. So I was just telling you before we started doing this that I have to get back on stage more often. I've kind of let that, you know, I live out in Pasadena now and I work all day writing for my show. I have another show on the web and so I'm always doing something or I'm hosting a show for the Young Turks I work for. So I'm busy all the time now. And so when nighttime rolls around, I want to smoke a joint and relax.
Yeah.
And I can't smoke a joint if I'm going to go do comedy. Right. So I got to put that off to now what, fucking midnight?
I know that happens, but it's just like, it's interesting because I'm just starting to realize this now that the guys that we, you know, even like the bigger comics now, like they are doing a lot of other things. And with Carlin, you know, I really think at some point he settled into being Carlin and, you know, he'd do Vegas sometimes. He was an icon, but he was only ever a comic.
He did have a sitcom for a little while on Fox, right?
And a little bit.
And he did some acting.
That cab driver or something, wasn't he?
I forget. I didn't watch it. But
everyone gets their little shot, even Rickles. But, like, yeah, Rickles is another guy. He's a comic his whole life. That's it.
CPO Sharky was a gem. Are you kidding me?
It was all right. I mean, he did some TV, but you know what I mean. Have you ever just poked around on YouTube and watched those motherfuckers when they were in their prime and just watch... Like, I was watching Dangerfield on The Tonight Show just the other night. I somehow was on YouTube, and someone sent me a link to something. So then I watched Dangerfield do a Tonight Show appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Spectacular. Because, like, it was, a lot of times guys like us, you know, either, guys who are overly personal or message guys, political guys, you know, you get into this weird insulated place in your head. And then, you know, if you just take a minute and watch one of those old guys just do straight up fucking pure comedy stand up, you're like, oh, my God, this is like unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. Like I went from Dangerfield to a Rickles singing. I'm like, oh, and I'm laughing out loud.
You know, to see Rickles do Pam, nobody does that. Nobody does it anymore.
He came out when Sinatra was a guest. He came out onto The Tonight Show when Sinatra was sitting there just as a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hilarious. He had, you know, it's weird because you talk about Hicks, but Rickles had huge balls.
It's
insane because he takes it right to the edge.
Yes.
You know, and you're like, oh, my God.
I agree.
How can anyone say that to Frank? You know, like... All right, granted, he wasn't taking down corporations, but, you know, he was speaking truth to power when he was saying Frank said, like, you know, Mr. Gambino said that maybe.
No, he, you know what? That was the sense of when late night talk shows, you had the sense of anything could happen and what, and they're kind of like doing something they're not supposed to do.
And also, but the entire culture knew who these guys were.
And the, yes, the entire culture knew who they were.
You know, it was like, there's a, Don Rickles was on the thing. Now, like, you know, somebody watches them on television and you're like, did you see the thing? Like, I didn't even know that was on.
Yeah.
Is that a new show?
Yeah.
Where do you get that? What network? I don't know if I get that network. Can you TiVo it? So, just to get to the guy. You gotta.
Do I get that network? Yeah, I don't even know if I get that.
What yeah, you... that's, a, well, that, that, that's my life. Telling my parents I got a show on IFC. What channel is that? Is that? I don't even know if I get
I told
that.
My, can I tell you what I told? So getting back to my parents and yeah. the support of my comedy career, when my our special on Comedy Central, it got Punchline Magazine named it in 5 top DVDs of the year. And so I told my dad, I go, Dad, guess what? Punchline Magazine named my special top 5 DVDs of the year. He goes, Punchline Magazine? And he goes, never heard of it.
Yeah.
that was his response.
With that tone? Oh, that, my that God.
Was, never heard of it. And I was like, here I am, 40 years old, still fucking getting blindsided by my father. When am I going to realize he's exactly the same?
No, it's hard.
You always think, well, they will be, oh, this, he'll like this. They won't be, no.
It's, well, it's always going to trigger that same.
Yeah. Feeling. Well, you know what I'm going through now is I'm realizing, you know, like I tell people, people go, how you doing? I go, well, my life has exceeded my dreams many times over, mm-hmm. and I still manage to be miserable most of the time. So yeah. I don't know how I'm doing it, but it is. And I realize that we all think the reason why I tried to achieve, try to be a good comedian, do things right, have discipline, was because I thought that if I achieved something, it would make me feel the way I thought I wanted to feel, which mm-hmm. was whole and mm-hmm. complete mm-hmm. and like I was worthy.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't. No matter what I create, no matter what I achieve, like I.
But you get a little self-esteem. I mean, that's the weird thing is that, like when you do achieve something, you at least feel like I know from doing this because I'm the same way
mm-hmm.
that like it's all right, well, I'm honoring myself. At least I have that. Like I'm being true to myself, mm-hmm. and that part is it feels good. There's a wholeness there. But the sort of like the component of happiness or feeling like, you know, I did it
yeah.
or that like, you know, everything's okay now because I know what I'm doing. It's still, that's not there. And it comes down to what I think what you're heading at is that, you know, if you can't give the approval you were expecting from your parents to yourself at this age, that hole's always going to be there.
Wow. That is, you know what? That is probably right because, you know, you keep thinking, I keep thinking that happiness is on the other side of achievement. Well, if it's always in the future on the other side, when I get there, how will I know? And I'll still be looking towards the next thing, which is how my life has worked out.
Yeah.
And so I just finally, so now here I am. And not only have I achieved more things that I ever think I could have, but here I am. I'm supposedly have arrived. I don't feel like I have. And in fact, I even feel a little bit fucking cheated because mm-hmm. I've achieved what they told me was supposed to make me feel great. And yet I don't,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's just like I still have this empty feeling. So now I'm starting to reevaluate how I relate to work
mm-hmm.
because I don't have any motivation to work anymore. Because if I know my achievement isn't going to make me feel good, what's the point?
Yeah.
So I have to re.
Well,
I have,
that's tricky.
Yeah, it's very. I'm going through a thing.
Yeah, I just find that, like, there's something about being denied something early on, like whether it's love or support uh-huh. or whatever, that there's still some part of you because it comes. It's supposed to be from your parents, where you're like you will still expect it. Like there's some sort of like I'll get it eventually.
Yeah. Yes, I think you're right.
And it, like the hard switch to make is sort of like. That guy's not going to give it to me. Yeah. So, like, either I got to sort of say, like, you did good. I'm proud of you and put your daddy mask on. Or you're just going to kind of keep wandering through life, you know, with that empty feeling. I struggle with it all the time. And I also struggle with the idea. It's sort of like, well, I'm making a living. I got health insurance. That's all I need. I might not die broke. Now, what do I like to do? I don't fucking know. Should I do more of what I like to do? I like to do 3 things.
No, what do I like to
yeah.
do?
Like, what are the things that, like, all right, I got a life. I don't got any kids. I don't got, you know, I don't have any dependents. I don't have a woman in the house making me nuts right now. So it's sort of like, well, I get the world's my oyster. I guess I'll sit here and jerk off. I can do anything I want.
I can do anything I want.
I like that porn clip I had yesterday.
Turns out this is what I wanted to do.
Yes.
Oh boy, this is revealing to myself,
right?
But for yeah, and so for me, I just feel like You know, the whole your whole life, you're told to prepare for this thing. Hey, you got to get good grades in school because and you got to go to a good high school. When you're in high school, you better get good grades on your SAT so you can go to college. And when you're in college, get you got to do good because you're getting ready. And then you start your job, whatever that is, and they tell you, you got to work. You're at the bottom rung. You're going to get to the top. And then you get to the top of the rung. It's the same shit.
Yeah.
It's, you're still like, what?
Well,
nothing.
Look, but we both know. I mean, you know, we're in a similar like sphere is that, you know, in our business, you know, there's always going to be the guy that hits the grail. So there's always that issue of like, sort of like, yeah, I'm doing okay. Yeah. But like, you know, I'm not set.
I'm not set.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like, you know, in my mind, it's like, if I ever got set, I'd do nothing. You know what I mean?
Well, that whole thing, if I got set, what would I do? Well, that I think I'm already doing it.
Still the same.
I think I'm already doing it,
right? You see these guys that are set. You see Jerry Seinfeld out doing dates again. I'm like, why? Why?
Well, in his movie Comedian, he answers that question. People always ask me, why? What am I doing this for? And he goes, I don't know. I just feel like there's something that I have yet to discover. And that's why I keep doing it. And I love Jerry Seinfeld.
Not my bag.
I just love most things. He's so right about comedy and, you know, and it's so funny. We do such different types of comedy, he and I.
I can't see that we ever would get along at all. Like, the thing is weird, and it's something you have too. It's interesting because, you know, if you come from a crazy household or you come from, you know, I don't know where he came from, but
he
like.
He seems very normal.
I don't think so. There's no fucking way.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, he's chosen the domain of normalcy to exhibit his genius.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something else ticking there. But the one thing I do know, and about Carlin too, and about why my guys are, you know, that more I more gravitate towards Pryor, is that, you know, I'm no control freak. You know, like I like to go up there and it's sort of like, I hope something fucked up happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and I like when control freaks lose their mind. It's one of my great hobbies. So like I'm a chaos guy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely chaos guys and there's control guys, you know, and Seinfeld's a control guy. It's like, he's all about the craft. He's all about the work ethic. He's all about this. And I'm like, well, that's why I don't see who the fuck you are. I don't know who you are. If some guy loses his shit, I'm like, I know who that guy is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that, it's a different thing with me because I think the risk of comedy is not wondering if this bit that you've labored over for months works. And I've gotten more like this. I've had to force myself to do this where it's sort of like, I'm going to work on a bit for 4 months. I got a 10-minute chunk here that I want to, you know, stay a story, and I'm going to put my craft to work and I'm really going to work this thing. And then and then you do it on TV and it's right. All right. It's garbage now. No, like I'm not, you know, I'm done with it, but it's rewarding, but there's nothing more rewarding to me than like something that I can't recapture.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I'm on the control end.
Right.
You know, not having my stuff, not knowing exactly what I'm going to do makes me nervous. It gives me comfort to have my jokes in my pocket.
I think that's a professional and a personal choice that makes sense.
And then when I do that show Setlist, like that's why I do that, because it scares the shit out of me every time I do it. Yet it always goes well.
Yeah.
And
well,
so,
you're a professional. We forget that sometimes.
I guess.
I've been doing this half my life. You know, what's going to happen up there? Okay, the worst, if I start crying, that'll be new.
Yeah, I've never cried on stage. I came close.
I have, but not at a stand-up show per se, but I've gotten emotional.
Really? I whenever I got up, you know, I would notice that my anger on stage would be that I didn't feel like my comedy was going to go over. Like, why are you hampering me? Well, one time I walked a room in Detroit, and it was the only time I ever did anything.
And
like,
they've been through some things.
And they've
you
been
must
through
have really...
Okay. Yeah.
What did you do?
It's a long story.
I got time.
So, no, just a table of women who didn't want anything to do with the show. It was the second show, and they wouldn't shut up. And I stopped to ask.
Did you say cunts?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Until they left.
Over and over again,
yeah,
you said cunts.
Over and over. But in a funny way, like lyrical, I would sing it sometimes.
And
I would just keep saying it.
But everyone left eventually?
They
sided with them.
Yeah, the waitresses started yelling at me.
Not a full house to begin with.
No, it was pretty full.
Oh, boy.
When you lose the weight.
That's it. Yeah, and they just want to go home early, so it served them either way.
But but that's one of those things I had to go through. You know, I think I had to do that. I had to.
Well, I mean, we do that. I mean, I do that thing where, you know, you look at a crowd or you get to the club and you make these weird assumptions. Like you're already at odds before you even get out there. You're like, no, I'm in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, and when you do politics, that exacerbates it. that, like, you know, I knew when I did politics and I would go do gigs, not only did I guess less people to the gig being billed as a political comic, but there's already people coming in going like, all right, let's see what team this guy's on.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they already decided you're not on their team, they're not going to go to the club. So you already have, you know, cut off yourself from a good deal.
That's why I've been fighting against that moniker of, you know, I like to think of myself more. I tried to be more of a George Carlin-esque, you know, and less of a, I don't know,
There's only a couple of them. You know, Bill Maher, but even he's pretty good.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just weird. I'm not telling jokes about the Taft-Hartley Act. I'm telling jokes about health care.
Can you explain that to me?
Or
then?
No. Okay. And I talk about it in the book, you know, like I talk about gay marriage and pot smoking, and I talk about sex and marriage and all that stuff. I talk about all the things. It's a thing. People think that politics is a game they can play sometime. And a perfect example is this guy, Andy Cohen, who hosts that show on Bravo, right? So about a year or two ago, he was making the rounds on all the talk shows, and he wanted to talk about gay marriage. And he would come on every news talk show, because I watch him also. I would see him over and over say the same thing, which was, you know, on my show, I'm not political at all. And I was like, really? You're not political at all on your show? You're a gay guy hosting a national television show. That's fucking political right there. That's like a Jew hosting a television show in Germany in 1930. You're already political. So you can't pretend. He's like, I'm not political. Oh, except when you stop to talk about the most incendiary political issue of our day, then you're political.
Yeah, but also, though, he has a right to it because it affects him extremely personally. See, that's what I found about politics, is that the thing is, if you talk about it in a general way, first of all, it's very hard not to be hackneyed. Very hard.
Yes.
It's very hard to actually have your own point of view on talking points from either side. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the issues I had with doing political talk, is that, like, one day you wake up and you're like, none of these are my ideas.
Right.
And I'm not saying they're not important ideas, but, you know, who am I carrying water for? But also, like, you know, if you can't speak sometimes from a personal place, like, how does this affect me? That really became sort of the deciding factor for me.
Right.
Like, if I sit here and I really engage, and I'm incredibly disengaged, that's also your choice as an American and as a person. It's sort of like, I'm not paying attention. Mm-hmm. Well, why not? I'm like, because I can. I don't have to pay attention. You know, I'm all right. You know, I pay my taxes. What do I have to fucking pay attention for? But I feel guilty about that. But, like, if I was to really sit down and, you know, think about the Palestinians, or think about, racism in this country, which I do occasionally, but, you know, more so than not, I end up thinking about myself. And is there a crime to that? No. But is that where I'm doing my comedy from? Yeah. Does politics sometimes get involved? Not as much as it should, but it does occasionally. But I have to come from that place, or else I feel like I'm doing myself a disservice. I feel like I'm being disingenuous.
Yeah. Well, you have to speak from wherever you are emotionally. That's where you have to speak from, you know. But the problem I have with a guy like Andy Cohen saying that, because it makes it sound like politics is a game you can play sometimes that nice people don't ever really bring up. It's rude almost to talk about it. He's just talking about this one little thing that happens to be inextricably tied to every other fucking thing. But he's just talking about it. He's letting you know he's not like one of those strident political types who's going to say anything that makes you uncomfortable. He's a good guy. As if it gives you a false sense that politics is a game you can play sometimes. What I try to tell people is that, you know, everything is politics. You want to smoke pot without going to jail? That's politics. You want to be able to marry somebody of the same gender? That's politics. You want to be able to get the pothole fixed in front of your house? That's actually politics. So everything is politics, and we do. And if you think it's not, you're just letting other people, rich people, decide what your community should look like.
Okay.
But I understand being disengaged is on purpose, like you are. You were super engaged, and then for whatever reason, emotionally or artistically, you de-engaged. That's different. You're not pretending that politics is a game you can play.
Well, it's also, but the choice is, it's a weird thing with politics. Sometimes people like to keep it private. Sometimes, like, when you just say that's politics, it's not essentially politics until you need to sort of figure out, well, why isn't this happening? Like, how is it unfair?
Like, if I want to go to a doctor and not go bankrupt, like, oh, right. Is that politics? Like,
right.
Turns out.
Right. Yeah. But a lot of people, like, you know, I don't even know how my insurance works. But you had health issues.
Yeah.
So it became a fairly
big deal for me.
What was the story of that? What happened to you?
So no, I had they couldn't diagnose it for a while. And I just kept kind of my condition deteriorated. And
what was it?
Turns out it was a bone problem. I had a tumor, very rare disease, like maybe two people a year get it.
How long ago did it first start happening?
So it started happening around 2004, mm-hmm. and then it just kept going. And I was
what was the symptoms?
Pain in everywhere, and then I had dead bone in parts of my body, my hip, and then I had a couple of vertebra break. I broke my back 3 times. And
what, because of this condition?
Yeah.
What's it called?
It was called osteomalacia, hypophosphatemic
osteomalacia.
But they
couldn't figure out what it was.
No. Well, here's kind of tell you a funny story. Is they would I would go to these doctors and they would go, oh, we think you have this, and then I turn 6 months later I'd get worse. They go, oh, you have something else.
They don't know.
And I go, who should I go? They go, you should go to this guy, Dr. Sharp. He's the best guy.
Yeah.
So I call him up and he didn't take insurance. I was like, well, I can't. It's going to cost me $1,000 just to walk in the door. I can't. What an idiot, right? So finally, I'm just about dead. I go, hey, let's go see that Dr. Sharp, and he figured it out. Like that. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, you have this thing. Nobody's ever going to know what this is. I saw this once before in 1968, blah, 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 blah. So then he got me on the right treatment and I feel good.
But what was the struggle with insurance? I mean, were you paying out of pocket? Did it
Oh, left and right. Yeah, it cost a lot of money. I had a couple of spine surgeries. And so, yeah, everything costs a lot of money. Yeah. Yep. And I didn't have a benefit. I didn't do that because I was dumb. It also caused a depression mentally in me, depression. So I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to look weak. Like I can't pay my own bills. So yeah. I didn't have one of those things. So I just paid for it anyway. But so that made me political. Mm-hmm. And that made me changed a lot of things in my life. Made me look at things a lot differently. It was one of the, yeah. It was what I was definitely like when Robin Williams or, you know, I was like, I know exactly what that's like. I know exactly you want to be right. You're like, oh, like, there's a real fine line between crossing that line and not crossing that line.
Could be just a bad morning.
Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, as an artistic type, you know, I got to remind myself every morning, this is going away.
Yeah.
this is going away.
Yeah, I do that too. Like I was fairly despondent and I felt a weird kind of heavy heartedness the last couple of days. And because like I'm a sober guy and like, you know, I've been through it before, I had to say like, no, there's a good chance this might go away.
Yeah.
You know, this ain't every day. This ain't going to be the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, you know, unless you hold on to it.
Yeah.
You know, right. No, it's not going away. We just talked about it for an hour. I know, but didn't help. You know, maybe you're committed to it. No, fuck you. See, now you're part of the problem.
But it's great. You know, I couldn't be happier now. I mean,
you
I could be a little.
Like the last time we had, like, I always felt it. Like the weird thing with you in terms of me is that, you know, I knew that, you know, when I did your show with your wife, we had a nice time. But I've seen you a few times. And I like if you're an angry guy, it's almost like being a Jew. Like, you
one
know,
time,
another angry
can I
guy.
Tell you one time you were at the Improv and you were on stage and you were doing the joke about Santa Claus.
What was that?
It's a long time ago.
What? I don't even remember having a joke about Santa Claus.
It's something about Jesus, Santa Claus is something. You had a joke, and it was funny, and and it was like a small crowd at the Improv, and I laughed, you know, and you know, I have a loud laugh. I let it go. I don't hold that in.
Yeah.
And you thought I was mocking you, and you go, "Oh, like, fuck you, Jimmy! You're fucking mocking me!" And I didn't want to yell out, "Hey, no, I'm enjoying this," because I didn't want to get any more into your set.
Right.
So I just shut up about it, and then I didn't tell you afterwards. I think I did go up to you and say, "You know, I was really just laughing.
Yeah.
I enjoy your comedy." And then you were like, "Yeah, you fucking Jimmy, you're sitting there mocking me." I'm like, "I wasn't mocking you. I was just enjoying you."
I'm so insecure.
I remember one time I was on the road, and because I had never, you know, you're a New York guy, so I hadn't really seen you that much, and there was a middle. And I was like, I'm pretty sure that's a Marc Maron joke. So I went online to look for your stuff, and I hadn't seen your Letterman sets. And I was like, well, those are really good.
Yeah.
And I emailed you. I was like, those are fantastic.
Well, here's the weird thing about angry people and about like what I maybe have done with you in the past. Because I thought we had a problem around, you know, Todd coming out.
No, you and I did not have a problem.
No, I know that. Yeah. But see, the thing about anger, about the other thing, about the laughter thing is that, you know, I'm going up there with this stuff and you make this assumption in your head that, like, you know, people aren't going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not going to be for everybody. So then what you end up doing is literally projecting the voice inside of you, which is like this, you know, they don't like you or this is going to suck or whatever. And you put it on other people. It's a load off. So like, you know, a guy like you, who I don't know that well. I'm like, well, you just did what I assumed everyone would do.
Right.
And you know, and I know you did that. Yeah. You know, I've been having a real issue with this shit. Perception.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what am I making up and what is real? Especially when it comes to other people, most of the time you're making it up.
Yeah, a lot of time it's projection.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, a lot of time it's projection.
It's crazy. And it, like, you know, if you keep pushing the projection enough, eventually they'll be like, yeah, I don't like you. You're right. Now I don't like you.
But and then when I was, you know, when I was coming back in, when I was getting better and healthier, I went through a thing where I got nervous to be on stage.
Yeah.
Ugh, oh, God. I was like, are you fucking, I was like, that made me angry. Like, it made me angry. Like, I was angry at this emotion inside of myself.
Crazy.
And, but that helped me. You know, like, it helped me get on stage, like, because it kind of reawakened an anger or something. And so my anger was stronger than my fear.
I haven't had that in a while. Like, Richard Pryor said, the only enemy of creativity is fear, because you don't know when that's going to come.
Yeah.
You know, and that feeling of, like, you know, especially after you spend 20 years of your life up there, and all of a sudden you hit with this, like, ugh, the vulnerability.
Yeah, vulnerability. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
I remember I was on stage at the Laugh Factory in Long Beach, and I remember it went through my head, what if they don't laugh?
Yeah.
I had never really thought that before.
Really?
I don't know. What if they don't like, I always knew they were going to laugh. I'm going to do, get in, like, what if it's quiet, silence?
Yeah.
There's nothing. Boo me. Do something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had that fear, and they, of course, they laughed and everything, but I was shitting my pants for some reason. I couldn't wait to get off stage, which I don't like that. I never had that feeling before. I can't wait to get off stage.
Well, the weird thing is like, you know, like, if that vulnerability is up right up next to you, you know, and I tend to, you know, sort of like try to live in it a little on stage. But if it's right there and it's not quite in line, like mm-hmm. if it's like a fear thing or a sad thing, mm-hmm. like that, you know, when you're up there, it's like if that gets out, you know, all bets are off. Like there's a moment there where you're like, because I was doing these huge shows and I'm like, if I really like let myself be like the sort of frightened, vulnerable person that I am right now, they're not going to laugh. I'm going to have 1,000 people going like, what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
With a weird silence, like, uh-oh. I know that's right there. And it, that moment where you're in that battle, like, that can't win. Like, I can't.
Well, I think, you know, you being vulnerable on stage, it has to be a very controlled vulnerability, because it's, you know, the old analogy people used to make about the comedians, like a lot like a pilot on a plane. You don't want your pilot to be nervous. Hey, I don't know.
That's right. That's true. You can't expect the audience to sort of parent you.
Right.
In a way.
Yes.
You can't go up there like, I'm lost. Do you know where my mommy is?
Yeah.
You know, you have to have that under control.
They're like, okay, if you know how this is going to work out, I'll let you be vulnerable.
Yeah. We trust you.
If I have a feeling that you know where this is going.
You got a handle on it.
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's
so.
That's the trick.
That's the catch 22.
So tell me all the things you got going on right now.
So I got this book, which is Your Country's Just Not That Into You, which I'm real proud of.
How's it doing out
happy
there?
Happy about it. It's doing great.
Good.
It's doing really good. Then I have a web series with the Young Turks. The Jimmy Dore Show is over there, and I have the Jimmy Dore Show podcast and radio show.
No more comedy and everything else?
It's a hiatus. Like, it's still up. People still download. We still get about 17,000 downloads a week on that thing. People like listening to those shows.
Yeah.
But no, we haven't done any more. I just been too busy doing other projects. You know, I was doing a tour with the Young Turks. We're doing live theaters and stuff.
Oh, great.
So now Ben Mankiewicz and I and Cenk Uygur.
They're good guys.
Yeah. So,
and they got a big operation over there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really nice.
And you're making a living.
And I can do it. Yeah. I can do and say whatever I want, which is the greatest thing.
Well, you seem great, and I'm happy that you're happy.
Well, thank you.
For the most part.
Yeah. For the most part, I'm happy.
All right. Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
That's it. That is my show. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get the app. Get some Just Coffee.coop. Get the get some knowledge on who's been on the show and who hasn't been on the show. Boomer lives!